makes the funny hat a symbol worth following. Be the Duke of Alshar, I said, and people will just naturally start treating you as the Duke of Alshar. The young man regarded me carefully for several long moments. What do you need from me? He asked simply. We had our sponsor. Following our quiet meeting with the orphan duke, we returned to the capital and stayed busy. There was a lot to do. There was some order business, some baronial business, and some domain-level business for Sevendor that all required my attention while I was in Castabrielle. Alia and I got into a fight and made up. We went to a few balls and had a wonderful time learning how to dance like nobles. We watched Tyndall come in third in his first big-time jousting tournament. I bought dozens of books and had dozens more copied from the Order's growing library to feed my collection back in Sevendor. I learned the intricacies of horse racing at the low cost of a few hundred ounces of silver. There was shopping. Oh, gods. There was shopping. We spent a week at Fair Oaks, Penny's local estate, and plotted and planned a few things of immediate concern. Now that we had our patron, we could figure out the basic requirements of a march like this. In a lot of ways, of course, it would be like marching an army. In a lot of ways, it would be nothing like marching an army. The needs of full-grown men, whose mission was violence, were different than the needs of roughly 2,000 adolescents. We talked about all the necessities, discussed the route, looked at some old maps of the region. Then Arborn showed up, and everything stopped. Everything around Penny, at least. She went from ruthlessly efficient bureaucrat to lovesick village girl the moment she saw him. Kasari custom prevented more than a formal greeting, but Penny embraced him anyway. Clearly the man enjoyed it, but he was also uncomfortable at the display of affection. But Arborn had come for more than passionately platonic hugs. He had a mission. I need a mage, spellmonger, he said, managing to be casual and formal all at once. There is an outpost of the Kasari in the Land of Scars, long abandoned, but a site of great respect and awe. It was among the very first settlements in these lands. For centuries it was a shrine of great importance and reverence among my people. Then why did you abandon it? Dark times, he said, shaking his head. The shrine was dedicated to watch over the groves, and that it did. But there are things in that land older than the trees, older than the Kasari. Evil things, as beautiful as the land was, and as important as the shrine was. Eventually it was given up due to the effect of the darkness in the land. Many of the details are lost, but occasionally the bravest among our folk will travel there, to visit the shrine and commune with its spirit. I've made the trip myself, in my youth. My scout Ald Endibanadwi. The idol there is said to come from beyond the void itself. That got my attention. Buried under the tangled web of revenge and genocide, the dead god and his minions used to rationalize their war against us, Humani, was some story lost to the depths of history. My recent discussions with the tree folk, the Alka Alon, the nearly immortal non-humans who had originally crafted the Gavani as a cheap, nocturnal labor force, had convinced me that there was a lot our ostensible allies in this war knew about those times than they were willing to let on. Humanity, it is known among the wise, did not originate on Kalador. We came forth from the void, on the lost horizon, voyaging to Kalador from the stars. Indeed, the first descriptions of us among the Alka Alon called us the Star People. That was a long time ago, and our once great civilization is long gone. The early Majocracy had been the high watermark until the tragic sinking of the island nation of Perwin by the last of the early Ark Magi. Once we ruled the skies and were accounted among the great races of this world. When Perwin sank, we began our long decline. We lost the skies when the cradle of our civilization was swallowed by the sea, leaving but a few colonies on the continent to carry on. Since then we've devolved into feuding barbarians, barely scratching a living in the soil, with only the vaguest idea of our past greatness based on our most ancient writings and a few impressive artifacts. Or at least that's what the Alka Alon seem to think. Me, I'm generally pretty happy with things, except for all of the goblins. But I couldn't deny that we had lost most of the civilization that had managed to bring us to this world. What knowledge the disaster of Perwin didn't wipe out, or wasn't destroyed in the scramble for the scraps after the inundation, my barbarian ancestors' mounted armies galloped over a few centuries later. The Narasi invasion of the later Majocracy effectively ended humanity's pretense of advanced civilization on Kalador. Now, we weren't much more advanced than the Gavanni we fought. Most of the records of the ancient times were stored in Merwin and Vor, the very lands that had borne the brunt of my ancestors' barbaric rage. There were remnants in outposts and temples, and the older cities in Merwin and Rhymir, but little of importance. Almost nothing to tell us of who we once were. So, if there was a chance to get some kind of look at the very earliest days of our settlement on this world, I was interested. How could an ancient shrine from the earliest days of humanity not be interesting? It got even more interesting when he told me exactly where the shrine was located. The heart of the Land of Scars. We'd crossed a great stretch of that remote and tortured landscape not 6 months ago, as we had pursued Shirul's armies up a magically frozen Poros River, into the foothills of the Mindans. It was a wild, twisted country, with sudden hills and steep defiles, ravines and rocky wastelands, breathtaking waterfalls and dense, deep forests. While technically part of Western Alshar, nearest the grand peaks of the Mindan Range, human settlements there were sparse at best, and rarely very far from gentler landscapes. The land had always been considered treacherous, due to the desperate men and dangerous predators who lived there. Since the place was now also crawling with goblins, hobgoblins, trolls, and worse minions of Shirul, who had survived the flood, its reputation had only gotten worse. The Land of Scars was notorious for being the haunt of beasts and savage tribes, bandits and desperate men, rebels, ghosts, and mysterious disappearances. Legends about the place abounded. Haunted forests, inescapable bogs, the taint of evil lingering in spots, and somewhere within its tortured vastness was the legendary ancient home of Korbal, the demon god of the Mindans, and the place of his immortal entombment. That was why the Kasari wanted to retrieve the idol. The shrine was just too dangerous to be visited any longer, now that it was crawling with goblins. Arborn explained the details of the task. A company of Kasari scouts would return to the ancient shrine overland, avoiding danger whenever possible and keeping out of Shirul's notice, and bring back the idol and any other important artifacts before it was overrun. The Magi were needed, because the idol was large and secured by the ancients in ways that befuddled the wisest of the Kasari. It was decided that magic was involved. Therefore, Magi would be needed to secure it. It sounded like the exciting adventure of a lifetime, and I was willing to help. Hells, I was willing to go myself, if I didn't have a beautiful wife, two young children, and a barony to run. I might have considered the jaunt myself. But that was irresponsible and impractical, and I knew it. As tempting as it sounded, I had to pass this dangerous opportunity on to those who would appreciate it best. If I was a younger man, and unattached, perhaps. Luckily, I had a couple of young, unattached, adventure-prone magi around who were suddenly without a war to fight. I'll loan you a couple of my apprentices, I decided. The older two.
Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondal?
Arborn asked, a little skeptically. They're smarter than they look, I promised. It's going to take at least a month or two to prepare for this march, and they're going to be instrumental in seeing it succeed. That means that they'll be working closely with the Kasari. I think it would be in everyone's best interest if we made certain they got to know your people before they're put in that position. I can spare them at the moment. They're competent high magi and warriors, and between the two of them they have half a dram of common sense.
They fought well at the lake.
Arborn nodded, though Pentandra looked concerned.
Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondal are quite young, she pointed out, shaking her head.
That earned an unexpected laugh from Arborn.
Young, my dear, they will be the most senior of the company. This quest has been sanctioned by our elders, but it has been assigned to those who have attained proper rank. Only those who have sworn the oaths of dedication of their lives to the Kasari Way will be participating, with a few stars of lower rank among them for support. These are candidates who are seeking the Raptor's rank, the highest attainment among my people. But it must be made before a man reaches 20 summers.
Why?
Asked Alia. Arborn shrugged.
That's the custom. It is how it has always been.
It might as well have been natural law, as far as he was concerned. I didn't feel hopeful about Penny's chances of seducing the proud barbarian.
Tyndall and Rundle will be senior, chuckled Alia, sipping wine like an aristocrat. The quest is doomed.
Don't say that.
They've commanded men in battle and in camp before,
I reminded her.
They even went and founded their own chivalric order while I wasn't looking.
They are smart, resourceful, and more talented and learned in magic than they let on. Perhaps more than they themselves realize.
No, this is the perfect challenge for my two apprentices. They've proven themselves as students, warriors, nobles, and leaders of men. Let us see how they account themselves as wizards.
You place a lot of stock in their abilities,
Penny said doubtfully.
I place a lot of stock in their resourcefulness, I countered, and their unwillingness to fail in the sight of the other.
Such rivalries have a place.
When they don't lead to bloodshed,
Pentandra said sourly,
but they do seem to land on their feet most of the time, she admitted.
I will have them sent to your camp, I proposed. Captain Arborn's men had largely returned to their homelands, but a remnant, a few hundred strong, lingered in Gilmora, in a ruined abbey they'd claimed as their encampment. Shall they bring anything in particular?
Courage, he said darkly. I've walked those lands myself. In much better days, they were tortuous to cross, and dangerous. At night, the winds and the mists conspire to mislead you. Strange voices will lure you to step over a cliff, or fall down a sinkhole, or run off into the night seeking those who have died. There are grottos and caverns that wind under the earth for miles, rivers that cannot be crossed, barbarian tribes of cannibals, wild mountain folk no less savage for lacking Shirul's taint, bandit hideouts, ancient tombs, the shades of the dead, ferocious predators, fell beasts from ages past.
It sounds perfect, I said, smiling. Just the kind of excursion my lads need to toughen them up for the march.
They'll be delighted at the opportunity.
They weren't, at all. In fact, they protested mightily that they'd earned a reward for their valiant service in the battle on the frozen lake. All of their fellow war magi were going off to their estates, or touring the resort cities of the south, or living riotously in the capital off of their newfound wealth. They were enjoying the company of many, many ladies of the city, and had likely formed attachments that could prove distracting to a professional man. All the more reason to insist. They were reluctant, but they understood their role. They left for Gilmora within a week, about the same time Alia and I were headed back to Sevendor. When I'd arrived at Castor Briel, I'd been upset over our treaty. Now I had a better perspective on our position. More importantly, I had the rudiments of a plan.
Chapter 3 Planning and Plotting. I didn't get another chance to focus on the march until after we got back to Sevendor and settled in. I spent a couple of days catching up on some business, mostly local issues for the domain, and then a day handling the baronial business. As usual, Sire Kay and his assistant, Sir Festaren, had everything well in hand. Want to know the best way to run a feudal barony? Hire people who know what they're doing and then leave them alone. But before a week had passed, I returned to the problem organizing the evacuation of the Kasari children. I started by summoning a few folks to my tower workshop to discuss the basic requirements for such an endeavor. Included in that first meeting were Sire Kay, the Dragon Slayer, Lady Lenadara, the Hawk Maiden, my youngest apprentice, Lady Ithalia, the Alka, Master Guri, the Stone Singer, Lorcus, the Rogue, Sir Festaren of Hosley,
Master Olmeg the Green, Master Bannermore the Spellwarden, my court wizard Draenus, and Gareth, the highly efficient deputy Spellwarden. Gareth's inclusion in the party might raise some eyebrows, I suppose, but the fact of the matter was that the failed war mage and trained thaumaturge had become a kind of genius when it came to logistics. He had helped run 3 magical fairs, and contended with the stray magi who haunted Sevendor Town, while simultaneously running the details of Master Bannermore's commercial empire. He also served as market warden, when needed, and had become a key figure in the logistics of the domain. He might be a mediocre mage, he was the only mage present who did not have a witchstone, but his attention to detail was magnificent. Once wine was poured and pipes were lit, I got started. As many of you know, as part of our agreement to secure the help of 1,000 Kasari rangers in the last battle, we agreed, coughed my court wizard loudly. I agreed to oversee the escort of roughly 2,000 Kasari children from their groves at Bransea Mountain, hugging the northern edge of the Penumbra in northwestern Alshar, all the way around the Pearwoods and the southwestern Colleen Spur, and up to the Kastali Wilderlands to Kasar proper.
"Wasn't that a stupid thing to promise?" asked Master Guri.
"It seemed like a good idea at the time, but I made the promise and I plan on fulfilling it, with the help of my loyal staff and a few hundred others. I've been thinking about this for months now. It can be done, if we prepare rigorously and execute flawlessly."
"So it was a stupid thing to promise," grunted Master Guri.
"Perhaps, but if it was, I'm about to compound that stupidity, to serve my own purposes." I looked around at each of them. It was time to convince them, as enthusiastically as possible, that I had a plan. "Let me tell you about what we're going to be doing this summer," I began, addressing my staff with the speech I'd practiced in my head. "This is going to be a different kind of adventure from what I ordinarily do," I explained. "I'm not attacking anyone. I'm not defending any place. I'm not leading an army. I'm leading a mass of non-combatants through a war zone. Our enemies won't be the goblins or the hobgoblins. It will be the terrain, time, and distance. To a certain extent, we can contend with these challenges with good organization and magic, which we will be using in plenty, for supply, for defense, and for support. Just like moving an army in a lot of ways. But in a lot of ways it won't be. We do have an advantage, in that with the pocket stone enchantments, I should be able to transport a lot of supplies without recourse to wagons, pack trains, or supply depots. The goal isn't to fight. It's to avoid fighting. It isn't to defeat the enemy. It's to move as quickly as we can between rest points. In fact, if we do get into a fight, I'll count it as a personal failure."
"And we do so while playing nursemaid to thousands of children,"
Dara said sourly. "The Kasari aren't like other kids," Lorcus corrected. "From what I understand, they have discipline and a devotion to order that will aid the effort significantly. They're a strange lot, for tribals, but they're reliable."
"We're going to need it," I agreed, "while King Rad has expressly forbidden any act of aggression against the Gavani. We apparently have a treaty. By giving me a commission to shore up the defences of the Penumbra, to establish a more secure watch over the Gavani, he gave me all the royal permission I need to pull this off. He even gave me gold to do so. Since his attention to the matter is waning, as he prepares to build his new palace, he's unlikely to give it more of a thought unless it becomes a problem. So, I want to use this commission and this gold to do exactly as His Majesty has requested. To that end, in addition to marching the Kasari through the Penumbra, we're going to use the opportunity of the trek to help fortify the string of iron-band outposts and garrisons. We're there to build 5 or 6 small fortresses along the way. Quickly. We're not there to defend them. We find our spot. We set up camp. We build the most basic fortification we can get away with in the shortest amount of time possible, and we move on before our foes have a chance to organize an attack."
"A bunch of kids are going to do that?" asked Lorcus skeptically. "That would be some mighty magic, even with the Kasari's flair for organization." I toured some of those iron-band forts, I reminded him. Most are pretty anemic. Reoccupied towers or keeps with wooden palisades and not much else. Why aren't they better? Well, because the defensive needs of the Wilderlords, who built them, revolved around keeping each other's raiders out. Not an army of goblins. The men who hold them are brave, but they would be swept away in a concerted attack. What we will build will be stronger. One of the problems with building adequate fortifications is a lack of workers in the region, I pointed out, beginning to pace in front of them as I explained my plan. The Wilderlands get less populated the more north you go, and around the northeastern edge of the Penumbra there are very few folk indeed. Without deploying the garrison at Tudri, there is no larger concentration of humans that could be put to work in the area. So, any real attempts at fortifying would be slow, costly, and easy to interrupt. I want a couple of variations of these towers, designed to be built simply enough so that even an army of children can put it together, with some magic and some qualified supervision. In some cases, we can use existing structures that can be repaired and restored. That is the secondary mission. Building the peeled towers across the northeast penumbra. That's how I was able to ostensibly arrange permission for this. And we'll have to have something to show for it. And we're going to need some specialized construction magic. I've already spoken to Taran, Andalnam, and our other enchanters about our needs. And they've agreed to help on the project. This will give the Hessian Order the opportunity to show what magical engineering can really do. After it's built, each tower will be staffed with a mage of the Hessian Order and a small garrison, able to watch and screen the penumbra.
You want to use kids as labor to build castles?
Master Guri asked, incredulously. He was professionally outraged by the idea. Not true castles, I amended. Even with magic, that would be challenging. I'm considering building simple peel towers, like the Warderlords used on the frontier of Gilmora and the Alshari Wilderlands. Small but sturdy stone towers, surrounded by a high wall, with perhaps a small gatehouse. Nothing more elaborate than that. But it would allow the men manning those posts some basic protection and a place to keep their horses secure. It would also be a visible, permanent human presence at the edge of the penumbra, clearly establishing our line of defense.
You can't honestly expect a single tower house and a bloody wall to keep out the goblins,
snorted the Karshak stone singer derisively. And when a Karshak snorts through their giant nose, it's meaningful.
One built for children.
When it is designed by the preeminent stone singer and master mason of the Karshak Alon, Master Guri, how could armies not break upon it like waves on a rock? I asked sweetly. Guri grunted again, but then he had to consider his own frequently touted greatness.
Yeah. He finally scowled. I can design something defensible that even your bairns can assemble.
He reluctantly admitted. I knew he would. The Master Mason and Stone Singer had forgotten more intriguing designs than most human masons would learn in one of our lifetimes. I also knew that appealing to his vanity would work.
Or can even spare a crew to help. We'll add a clause to the contract. Damned Humani barbarians,
he mumbled through his great beard. But the goblins of the Penumbra are just part of the problem. We'll do what we can to keep the major bands pinned down and away from us. But the landscape is going to be against us too. The Alshari upcountry is rugged as the land of scars. In fact, if you go northeast of our route, you get to some of the most impassable and tortured land I've ever seen. For all practical purposes, Alshari political identity fades around there, but then so do most of the people.
The Kasari are, unfortunately, seen as unsavory by many of the Wilderlords, admitted Sire Kay. I myself have dismissed them as vagabonds and thieves in the past.
He'd learned better since. On our campaign up the frozen Poros, the Dragon Slayer had gotten to know many of the vagabonds and had come to a better understanding of their culture and a higher respect after he watched them fight at the Frozen Lake. What few Wilderlords are left in the region may object to such an army of Kasari, even of children, passing by their doorsteps. If they do, They will do so in violation of their sworn oath to their duke, I smiled. While I was at Castabriel, I had an audience with His Grace Anguin, the young Duke of Alshar, and he was good enough to give us his commission to transfer his subjects in writing. Any will the lord who doesn't answer to the duke's command will be deemed a rebel. And what is the little lad going to enforce that with? Lorcus smirked. A ducal edict? That will be terribly popular in a region where most lords can't read. They will be judged by the duke's appointed marshal, I said, and sentenced accordingly. And that would be me. His Grace was also kind enough to renew the commission his father gave me before Timberwatch. Any lord who doesn't cooperate with the march is asking to get his manor sacked or confiscated, or both. Our proposed route will take us through the very northern reaches of Alshari-controlled territory, and even that's pretty nominal. The few will the lords left around there have been under near constant attack for the last 3 years by the Gavani. There's no economic infrastructure left there to speak of. What military strength was there was consumed in the first year, when the barons tried to respond to the invasion. The ones who remain are tough. They're used to ruling without oversight. Most of them are illiterate and uncultured beyond the list field, and they have very tenuous ideas about their responsibilities under the law. We have as much to fear from them as we do the Gavani. More, many of them bear a great antipathy for the Kasari, thanks to the years of bush warfare between the Kasari and the Wilderlords over their territory. Marching a couple of thousand of them through is going to take some negotiation, some threats, and perhaps some action. The terrain remains treacherous, and the countryside hostile until we get to about 50 miles from Tudri. Once we reach Tudri, the worst of our journey will be behind us. The roads are relatively safe and well patrolled from there to the frontier, and from the frontier to Kasar they should be clear. But that doesn't mean that our troubles are over. A great number of Castali lords fear an invasion of Wilderland's refugees. They have agitated strongly with the Duke of Castal, that's Prince Tavard, to prohibit any mass movement across the border. Didn't the king decree that refugees could cross the border? Dara asked.
He did, Draenus agreed, but he is no longer the Duke of Castal. Under the royal charter that created the kingdom, the dukes, not the king, have responsibility for enforcing those edicts. If Tavard's barons don't want to let anyone cross, and he supports them, there is little that Rard can legally do about it.
There are exceptions, reminded Lorcus. Supposedly high nobles, merchant houses, clergy, pilgrims, tax officials, inspectors, students or apprentices on their way to their vocations, soldiers on their way to or from deployment, prisoners and those with other such regular business are permitted to traverse the ducal frontier. But in practice, you had better have good business, or your patents of nobility in order, or you aren't getting across. Of course, a heavy purse will always grant one access. He added, My purse isn't that heavy, I complained. We'll find a way. By magic or the will of the gods, we will. I'm truly not as concerned with that part as I am getting everyone out of the Highlands alive. If we can make it to Tudri, I'll consider the rest of the journey trivial. Now, does anyone have any observations?
With high magi, we can add additional enchantments to stabilize the foundations, suggested my court wizard Draenus, and create a system of communication akin to the Great Mirrors.
That had been one of my, okay, Bannermoor helped, better ideas that was now causing waves all over the kingdom. The chain of magical communication spells we'd set up under the Order's auspices now allowed vital news and messages to be relayed from one end of the far-flung kingdom to the other. 7 of the 9 mirrors were working, and merchants and nobles had started using them with frequency. The key to their power was the sympathy stones, magical resources harvested in the hills 50 miles north of here. Bannermoor and I had arranged for the local lord to harvest them as the byproduct of a clothing dye that he was getting rich off mining from his otherwise barren land. Every few tons of dye-bearing clay resulted in a few magical sympathy stones, which Bannermoor harvested, and business had been good. While the demand for them made each sale a profit for me,
I had enough in storage to place at least a few mirrors along the penumbra. And it's not like I needed the money.
Exactly,
I nodded. Magic is going to be essential to this mission, and not just war magic. We're going to need it for supply, too. That's where the pocket stones come in. There's no way we can carry enough provisions by foot to make the entire journey, and even the Kasari would have a problem foraging for enough along the way to keep going. Moving bulk foodstuffs overland through hostile territory is just asking for trouble. And I hate to hire 10 men-at-arms at 4 silver each to escort 3 silver worth of beans and corn 100 miles. We should, with the help of the pocket stones, be able to transport a lot of that magically instead.
If we moved a 40-ton barge, moving a few sacks of grain should be easy enough,
Sayake agreed. He was technically a mage knight, but he was a sport. His powers were highly limited. But he had been around Magi for a few years now, and he had an excellent layman's grasp of magic's limitations.
But it occurs to me, Mage Lord, that a few company of horsemen would be able to aid in security as well as in supply. Can we not deploy the cavalry in this mission?
Spoken like a true knight, chuckled Lorcas wickedly.
I've walked in those wilderland domains. You need more than 4 feet of level ground to charge, and most of the so-called roads look like goat trails. You can use a horse up there, but not for warfare. They use llamas, donkeys, and chevrines, mostly for pack animals. They're the only things that can stand on the bloody land and not fall off. He was a professional war mage, and a good one. He respected the heavy cavalry that was the backbone of the kingdom's military, but he recognized their limitations as well. It was a popular opinion amongst the magical core of the world that knights knew only 2 commands, charge valiantly and die nobly. Any mercenary war mage with a few years of service had seen plenty of idiot nobility do both.
Lorcas is right, I agreed. Horses are going to be impractical until we get to the central wilderlands, and even then, supplying them with fodder and shoes and such will only add to the logistical problems and the security problems.
How are a few companies of knights going to add to the security problem?
Asked Sayake, amused.
Because we're trying not to attract attention, and all those knights will do just that, without being able to help much in defense,
Lorcas pointed out. So what are we going to do about security? He asked me.
War magi?
Among other things, I agreed. First, I'm anticipating a contingent of Kasari rangers to escort us, and that counts for a lot. Further along the way, we can enlist the aid of the Iron Band, the Megalini Order, and the troops at Tudri, if we need to. But the fact is we're going to be travelling through dangerous territory without those resources at hand through much of the journey. So, we're going to use deception and camouflage, subterfuge and misdirection to steer our foes away from us long enough for us to pass.
Sneaky, Lorcas nodded in approval. I like it.
That means intelligence of our enemy's movements is going to be vital. So yes, we'll be using war magi a lot, including the Skyriders, I said, glancing at Dara. With them flying cover, we should be able to see trouble coming even if it evades our scrying. And they are getting better at combat. Do you think they're up to that, Dara? My young apprentice swallowed nervously. She had personally overseen and trained the first generation of hawk riders, their steeds the transgenically enchanted giant hawks that the Alka Alon had helped create. There were 6 of the birds, at least, and more being bred and transformed. The Sky Riders were mostly young men and women, some with magical talent, and a few daredevil Tal Alon, who Dara had recruited. Dara led them on her own transgenically enchanted falcon, frightful, and they had proven instrumental in the recent war, as had Dara herself.
We'll be ready, she nodded. I'm sorting through new candidates now, but if I have a few weeks, I think I can put all 6 hawks in the air. Maybe 7. And frightful, she added.
A 7-bird squadron will be plenty, I think, I nodded. It will be hard, but I think that it will aid us immeasurably to have that support. The more we can see the goblins, the more we can avoid them.
There are worse things than goblins wandering through the penumbra now,
reminded Lorcas, who had been there recently on a mission for me.
Nightsails, rippers, great goblins, hobgoblins, and plenty of wild beasties ready to devour a stray child. Indeed. Which is why not attracting undue attention is key. We'll be disguising our movements, and we'll break up the march into blocks of a few hundred, to stay organized. We'll know a lot more about the specifics come late spring, when we start off, after the melt has passed and the rivers are crossable. The Kasari are thoroughly scouting the entire route in preparation. Captain Arborn is doing what he can to make this a smooth and easier journey for his kinfolk as possible. What he's worried about is local resistance, once we get into Narasi territory. "What of the Alka, Alon?" asked Draenus. "Can we depend upon their assistance?" "Good question. Lady Ithalia, this is going to take a lot of logistical travel, even before we begin the march. Can I count on you and your sisters to aid us with the Alkan ways?" The stunningly gorgeous woman with the pointy ears and the copper-coloured hair bowed gracefully from the neck.
"Alas, the Alka Alon Council has recalled all of us to contend with the influx of refugees from the Wilderlands and Anthatiel. Thousands now fill our strongholds," she explained. "Most of our refuges in the region you call the Wilderlands were abandoned in the last few years, as our kindred fled the Abomination's minions. Now we have thousands more from the City of Rainbows who need to be succored."
"You cannot help us at all," I asked, dismayed. "I was counting on them."
"I wish I could pledge a contingent of Alka Alon warriors to accompany you, but every hand is needed to supply and protect our own people until we can get them settled in new homes and the council meets to debate the situation and concoct a plan."
"Surely the mighty Alka Alon can spare a few warriors," Lorca said, clearly enjoying the feeling of superiority Athalia's admission gave him.
"As important as the Kasari evacuation is, it is a low priority for our kindreds," she confessed. "What folk we have who can be spared are searching the wilderness, seeking news of our lost kin. Many Alkans of high importance are missing, it appears, and their fates are of great concern to us."
"That's unfortunate," I said, my heart sinking. I was really hoping the tree folk would be more help, after all we had done to try to help them.
"If it is some consolation, Mage Lord,"
Lady Athalia said sweetly,
"we have been granted permission by the council to instruct you in the use of the waypoints."
That was great news, and surprising. The waypoints?
"Your kin trust me that much?"
"Not particularly," she said candidly, "but after much debate, it was decided that you were unlikely to foul the waypoints up too badly."
I didn't argue with that because I couldn't. I graciously accepted her offer. That would help things along significantly, too. A great many things. If I didn't have to spend so much of my time plodding across the landscape, or riding barges up and down rivers, I could get a lot more accomplished. "That brings us to the matter of supply," I said. "For this mission, I wish to appoint Gareth as the Manciple."
"Manciple?"
asked Lady Ithalia, curiously.
"Manciple?"
asked Gareth, clearly not pleased with the appointment.
"The official in charge of procurement, usually for a temple, monastery, or academy," explained my court wizard Draenus. "An admirable choice, sire."
"I could argue that,"
groaned Gareth, expressively.
"You get to go tramping off into the Wilderlands on an adventure, and you want me to buy beans and bacon and flour?"
"And boots and blankets and a good many other things," I said apologetically. "Supply issues are going to be crucial in this mission. It is not an easy task, I admit, nor a glorious one, but it is an absolutely essential one, and one I can only entrust to the one best able to see it fulfilled." Gareth gave me a sullen stare, and glanced briefly at Dara, who was studiously looking out the window.
"Fine," he agreed with a snort of disgust. "Whatever you need me to do to help."
I was sympathetic to the young man, but despite a few years in Sevendor, he was still no war mage. While his scrawny body had filled out in our prosperous domain, his frame was still short and scant, not the kind of man you'd imagine wielding a mage blade. But with a quill, he was magnificent.
He was an adept bureaucrat and possessed a nimble and well-educated mind. He had experience dealing with tradesmen and merchants, and he was a competent and certified imperial mage. In the field, he would be a handicap. Behind the lines, feeding us as we went, he was a valued member of the team. Perhaps not obviously heroic, but just because you want to be a hero doesn't mean that you can be. I figured it was best to not dwell on his disappointment and move on. To do this right, we're going to have to use a lot of very specialized magic, I suggested. For the things I have in mind, we're going to need a few enchanters. I'll handle that element myself, selecting the ones I trust. I want to do everything we need to do, without involving a lot of other people.
Why does it matter if we involve a lot of other people?
Dara asked innocently.
Because there are many and diverse folk who would oppose such a disruptive transfer of so many people, my dear, for reasons of their own,
Bannermore supplied,
particularly when they are the Kasari. But I think Minolan's saying that if our preparations are done quietly, and then the plan executed without their knowledge, by the time they realize what we've done, it will be too late.
That is the theme of the plan, I agreed. If we do this right, we can achieve a whole host of things at once that will be a boon to many and all.
Conversely, it could start a civil war in the New Kingdom, Lorcas said.
That is also a slight possibility, I conceded, which is why we're moving very carefully and very quietly.
Tell no one about this who doesn't have to know, I cautioned. The last thing we need are people raising objections before we've even started.
I don't like it, Alia said, pouting, as we prepared for bed downstairs in our bedchamber, later that night.
I had just explained the basics of my plan to her, and the results of my meeting, when she frowned and gave her verdict.
Which part? Where to begin?
She asked.
A clandestine mission against the wishes of your duke and king? The dangerous cross-country dash? Dodging goblins the entire time? Min, you're used to armies and trained soldiers. These are children,
she reminded me.
You can't just command them like mercenaries.
These are Kasari children, I reminded her. Every one of them can read and write, something you can't say about Sevendor. They've been through their preliminary rites, from what Arborn told me, and they will be ready and equipped for the march, organized even. The Kasari are taking care of all that, I dismissed.
With rangers,
she pointed out. Big, tough men with bows and swords, which will be ideal for protecting them. But what about keeping them going, keeping them organized and cared for? I shrugged. Who would you recommend?
I'd recruit some of the clergy,
she decided. We've gotten quite a few pilgrims since that mysterious pillar of flame appeared in town on the site of Brigga's new temple. Not all are brigadines. A lot of them are monks and nuns of other various orders. See if our clergy can help quietly recruit the people we need to care for the children along the way.
That's not a bad idea, I agreed. Wilderland's clergy would be better, perhaps, more akin to the Kasari. I think it matters not. Just that there are some to shepherd those poor boys and girls, keep them warm, fed, healed, and happy.
I'll see what we can come up with. Any other objections?
Not at the moment, but give me a little while,
she said, shrugging. Then she regarded me more seriously.
You're just humoring me, aren't you?
What? I asked in surprise.
You're just asking my opinion to make me feel included, aren't you?
She accused.
Alia, I'm doing no such thing. I value your opinion more than most of my counselors. I can trust you to give me your unvarnished perspective without worrying that you're trying to get something out of me. The list of people I can do that with is rather short these days.
I don't mind you going, even though you just got back from a battle, she said, after a moment's consideration.
It isn't nearly as dangerous as the Frozen Lake, and the dragons, or even the Boval Vale.
No, it won't be, I assured her. It's going to be a pleasant walk through the country with a bunch of happy children for 700 or 800 miles.
I'm just going to miss you. Again, every time I think you're back to stay for a while, something else comes up.
She sighed, her hands on her hips.
I suppose it could be worse. At least this will be instructional.
Think of all the vicarious paternal experience you'll pick up, she smiled amusedly. From the exercise our boisterous boy Minalian was giving her every day, I could see how she might think I needed it. I'm sure I'll return a font of paternal wisdom, I agreed, taking her into my arms. I'm sure you'll return footsore and bitter about children in general, she chuckled. But no battles, she sighed, as I embraced her. No big ones, I agreed. Only the lightest, most gentlemanly of skirmishes. Am I supposed to rule Sevendor in your absence? Again? She added, with a sigh into my shoulder. Ah, so that's where this was going. Is that a problem? I asked, breaking my hug. Not as such, she admitted carefully. The yeomen and Sire Kay have everything working well now. When you're gone, I barely have anything to do, aside from council meetings, and the occasional siege. Ouch. One little siege. The truth is, I get a little bored, she admitted with a shy smile. I enjoy the company of the castle ladies. Lady Estret is terribly gracious about including me, if I wish to sip tea or wine and engage in gossip, and there are always the children to look after. And I have started to read a bit, she added shyly. While my bride was literate, she was still not very confident in reading even simple Narasi. I'd purchased 3 books I'd thought she'd like when we were in Castabriel. It was gratifying that she was attempting them. As one of them was a simple translation of Perwanese erotic poetry, I did have a vested interest in her success. Well, hold a festival or something, I suggested. Find some worthy monk or nun who wants to build an orphanage and sponsor them. Do something that will make you feel good, I urged her. You are the Lady of Sevendor. You should enjoy that.
Maybe,
she said, chewing her lip and thinking. I was also thinking, you know, I love how close we are to everyone, living here in the tower, she said slowly, and I know we're going to move, eventually, into the new castle when it's finished. But Master Gurry says that will be years yet. Min, would it be permissible to consider building us a nicer hall? Perhaps just across the yard, overlooking the wall? A proper hall? Undefended, you mean? Unfortified? She corrected, using proper military terminology. Just a simple manor house where we can have a little more comfort and a little more privacy.
I don't see why not,
I said, after giving it some thought. I do like being close to the great hall here, but I suppose we're also getting a little crowded, aren't we?
Just a bit,
she admitted, in a way that told me it was an understatement. Just tell me what part of the bailey I can build it on, and I'll take care of the details. It will have to be richly appointed and comfortable, I said mockingly. I'll have none of those austere rooms and stoic cells that you are so fond of.
As my lord commands, she chuckled. Really? I can build us a new hall. It might be expensive.
I just got the annual reports of our sympathy stone sales from Bannermore, I pointed out. We can pay for it out of that alone. Just one thing. Make sure there's a tower on it.
A tower? You want a refuge that close to the castle?
It can be decorative, I conceded, but I like to look out over the valley at night. It helps me think.
I can do that,
she agreed. And you really don't mind me building a new home while you're gone? I shrugged again. Are you kidding? That means I double my workshop space, and I won't be disturbed as often by crying babies. How is that a bad thing?
Chapter 4 Scouting the Penumbra. The ways of the Alka Alon are one of several methods one can magically travel long distances, Lady Varen explained to me in the upper chamber of the tower that erected atop Matten's helm, called Lesgathiel in their language, a beautiful name for a beautiful place. They are, by far, the easiest way that we know of. Long ago, the Alka noticed that what you would call arcane fissures in the structure of space on the curvature of this world, could be breached, and unite for a moment. When the proper songs to open them, and then connect them were composed, it became relatively simple, with a little effort, to use these ways to transport. So the waypoints are naturally occurring phenomena? I asked, genuinely curious.
Mostly, she conceded. Consider instead that they are potentialities that occur naturally and can be wakened and exploited by the right songs.
I'm no spell singer, I warned. I can barely carry a tune. Verin gave me a rare smile.
Few mortals can manage the subtleties of our song spells, magical or musical, but thanks to Onranian's gift, you needn't strain your voice,
she said with light sarcasm. I didn't mind. She was so beautiful that she could have been viciously insulting my mother, and I would have been happy to listen. Onranian, the reprobate old Alkan spellsinger who I'd helped rescue from a besieged treehouse in Alshar, had been grateful enough to augment my witchstone into the witch sphere I now bore. He had also loaded it with Alkan song spells, a scandalous gift to a mere mortal. I had attempted only a few of the strange magics. I was wary of them.
The Alka spells in the witch sphere, I said, nodding toward my faithful rock.
I had it out, floating around, just because it's really too big to wear comfortably most times.
Yes.
Lady Verin nodded.
The sphere contains the spell to open and to connect the points. But those are useless to you, unless you also know how to select a destination. That is where the art of the waypoints comes in.
So, is there a map? I asked. Some sort of list that I can refer to?
Sadly, no, she said, shaking her head prettily. Our ability to recall makes such a thing unnecessary. Once an Alka has been shown the way, they remember it forever. When introducing someone to the ways, usually the novice is guided until they can feel the way themselves. But in introducing a Humani to the ways, we have devised a way around your natural limitations.
I felt kind of honored and insulted at the same time. For the next 2 hours, she taught me the essence of the special spell the Alka Alon had devised to allow me to use the magical portals. Onranian had been involved, I could tell. Don't ask me how, but I detected a note of his signature magic in the spell. They had kindly broken it down into a complex, masterful transliteration of symbolic imperial magic. As spells went, it was elegant, complicated, and sublimely well-prepared. It figured that the Alka Alon could do imperial magic better than Humani. When we were ready to try our first assay into the ways, Verin chose waypoints to places I'd been already first. Each waypoint, I discovered, had a different arcane signature, an address of sorts. Once I was able to understand them that way, without all of the music getting in the way, then the process became relatively simple, if exhausting. Transference itself wasn't tiring, but the opening of the waypoint, and the mass of the object moved, required a fair amount of power, enough to wear your mind out quickly. I couldn't imagine an imperially trained mage doing it without a witchstone, and not one of the little ones. I thought back to the massive amount of mass we'd moved to Cambrian, and suddenly understood just how fatigued the emissaries had been afterward. Apart from the fascinating arcane aspects of the experience, the practical benefits were clear. I could move around the kingdom without all that tedium and expense of actually moving, and I could, as Lady Verin demonstrated, take a few passengers along the way. More than three would be a strain, she cautioned, for a weak mind like mine. I tried not to take that the wrong way. She showed me several waypoints I might find useful some day, including ones near to Castabriel, Wilderhall, Gilmora, Tudri, and a dozen other places that harbored them, some of them quite surprising. The distance didn't seem to affect how much power was involved, thankfully. There were apparently some waypoints where this was the case, for no reason she could explain. Lady Verin showed me how to store each location in my witch sphere for future reference, which was helpful. But after a dozen trips around the kingdom, and a few places beyond, I was exhausted. Even war magic spells to keep my fatigue at bay weren't working by the end of that day, and my head was buzzing with the individual flavors of each site I visited when it wasn't pounding from the headache I'd developed. I stayed in bed for most of the next day, and slept off my indulgence in wanderlust. But a lot of things got simpler after that. I learned that the special waystones that had been mined from my mountain each had their own special signature. The Alka Alon used apophyllite as a means of securing a waypoint permanently. I happened to have a whole collection of slightly enchanted apophyllite gems that could also reduce the local magical resistance to effectively nothing. That made establishing new waypoints for use relatively simple. The 8 stones I'd given the Alka Alon, 3 for the emissaries, 5 to their council, allowed the bearers to effectively transport themselves from anywhere. It gave them a lot of power to help order their realm. I, too, had that power now. One of the magical gems in my warstaff, Blizzard, was a waystone, and when I wasn't using Blizzard, it was secreted away in an arcane pocket dimension tied to a ring on my right hand. If I needed to transport myself, I summoned my staff, began the spell from the witch sphere, and away I went. I was getting good at this stuff, I think. I had a lot of enchanted apophyllite, too, far more than the Alka Alon suspected. Over the course of the next few days, after the Alka Alon had retreated to their conferences, I began by putting stones in places I thought they would be useful, as I practiced using the waypoints. At the top of Matten's Helm, at the Dyke Tower, at the tower in Brestal, and one in each of my client domains. Just to be thorough, I had Dara ride one out to Chepstow Castle, and had Bannermore install one at my new house in Sendaria Port. When did I get a house in Sendaria? Sire Kay arranged that. Among the possessions I'd inherited when I conquered Sire Gimbal's Rump Barony had been a collection of halls and townhouses owned by him and his former vassals. Sire Kay took one for his own use, with my permission, and sold 2 of them at a profit. The finest home in Sendaria Port he reserved for me and my household. It was our permanent station on the busy riverport, staffed by a pair of servants against our arrival and use. It had a stable, a massive fireplace, 2 well-appointed chambers and a small hall. It was much preferred than taking our chances with a local inn. Now I could get to it in 2 minutes, not 2 days. It was quite an exciting feeling, plunging through the magosphere all alone. It was difficult at first, and required a massive amount of arcane power, but with practice it became another spell at my disposal, a powerful one, and more importantly, one I could make excellent use of in preparation for the march. While I was gallivanting around, learning Alkan magic, it wasn't just to get out of real work. I had people to visit. I had things to arrange if I wanted this trek to work well. After I had rested up from testing my initial installations, I went further afield and began to quietly put together the pieces I needed to play this game. Installing an apophyllite stone at the Order's tower in Castabriel gave me a much easier way to access the city, compared to the dingy cellar that was Castabriel's original waypoint. While I was in the city, I went ahead and took care of some business. I paid a visit to Master Hartarian, the royal court wizard. Hartarian and I had managed a good working relationship for the past year, after he stepped down as the censor general for the new position. Despite spending most of his life trying to restrict or kill errant magi, he had become just as adept at administering and regulating them on behalf of the kingdom. He was more than happy to meet with me without an appointment. No one likes to keep the spellmonger waiting, and he was glad of the break in packing. While their majesties were planning on staying the summer in the capital, the prince heir and his new bride were planning on moving the ducal court to Wilderhall, and Hartarian was going along because of its proximity to Wenshaw. He was intrigued by what I had to tell him. No, I didn't mention the trek outright. Too many of the family lurking around court for that, and I didn't want them to know about it. Duke Anguin was still being carefully watched by Queen Grendine and her coven of killers. I didn't want to implicate a man without his consent. Instead, I explained my summer affair as a dutiful attempt to magically shore up the defences of the northeastern sector of Wilderlands against the darkness and chaos of the penumbra. I casually mentioned I would be assisting the Iron Band with expanding the Iron Ring and aiding the Hessian Order in the construction of a few fortified outposts,